Well, I did, the secret that I'm about to announce is like, man, I'm telling you, Stan, probably you cut it shorter now, man. It gave me nothing but unconditional love and everybody, and no matter if you're man, woman, young, old, alcohol, drugs, didn't matter. And Billy has never told me, no, wait a minute, I'm busy. Never's always dropped. What are you doing? Anyway, I'd like to make your crime, you know.
Welcome to the Saturday Night Crime Festival. I'm so touched and here to see each of you here. And friends said they'd be here, and they're here. And welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Did I say my name is Billy? I'm an alcoholic. Okay. And I'm here to talk to the newcomer. And to say I still love to drink. Okay. And I drink water, drink coffee. Used to drink soda, but it was too rough on my gallbladder, so just water and coffee. And like I say, Miller time comes up. Just because I'm sober doesn't mean it's not Miller time. But when it is Miller time, I drink water or coffee. I know I'm an alcoholic. I have no illusions about it. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, what I mean is that if I take a drink, craving's going to kick in. And I have no doubt about that. And if I drink and that craving kicks in, then I'm going to go where alcohol takes me. And I did that for a long, long time. In the last couple of years of my drinking, I swore it off every day. And by sometime in the afternoon, I got started again. And it went on like that, like I said, for my last couple of years. And then there came a day, like 20 months before I got sober, this woman friend, Laura, drowned. Her car was washed off the road in a major storm. It was washed off the road up in Refugio Canyon. And we had been seeing each other. She was like the love of my life at that time. And then we weren't seeing each other for a while because I needed to grow up a bit. I was very possessive and jealous and stuff like that, and it wasn't good. And I figured I'd let the winter go by, and she was actually married and separated and getting divorced. I figured I'd let her go through what she's going through. I'll go through what I'm going through. And then I'll hook up with her, give her a call around her birthday in February. And January 19th came up, and I got a drunk driving. I was a block, half a block from my home, got my last drunk driving. And there was potholes on the road between my workshop and my apartment, and the front end of my international pickup was totally loose. And when I hit the potholes, my truck was going like that, and the cop saw that and pulled me over. And my first thought was, what will Laura say? You know, there was a bond that that was potentially there, and it was potentially lifelong and potentially very strong. And as it happened a few days later, I turned on the TV, and I never turned the TV on in the morning at that time, but there was the news, and there was this car, and the roof was peeled back like a sardine can, and this woman named Laura was lost in this storm. They found a car, and it, back at Refugio, you get off the highway, and the road goes back toward going up the canyon, and it goes up over a bridge, and then down into a culvert that's usually dry, and then on up the canyon. And there's this major, major rainstorm, and this major rainstorm was going on. It had been raining for like 5 days. The ground was saturated, and then this major rainstorm, and she was going up to her mom's, who lived at the top of the Refugio Canyon. And she apparently went back and was just flying up the highway, freaked out or whatever, and hit the, instead of the culvert, dry culvert, it was the raging torrent. Washed the car around under the bridge, peeled back the roof of her car, and they found the car, and they never found her. And in those days, I remember walking the shoreline, you know, for 5 or 10 miles and just looking. And And I had met her soon-to-be ex-husband, I'd met her dad, her mom, her stepdad, all these different people, but there was no remains that were found, and I didn't have the emotional response for life to touch base with these people who were loved ones of this woman I loved. And as it happened at that time, which it was all that, you know, it was that way for a long time, it was pot and alcohol that was my go-to and emotional response. And I rented a room from a guy who had a two-bedroom apartment. He came home, he was the guy that had pot, I had always had beer. But he said, "You want a kid?" And I said, "Yeah." And I told him about Laura, and I remember her being in the living room, and I was thinking at that time, if I would just die, I could be with her forever. And it was, that was, you know, plan A. And under the influence of pot and alcohol, I could see her in the room, and she was saying, "Live." I just heard her say, "Live." And anyhow, that was 20 months before I got sober. And obviously, I didn't kill myself, and life is, you know, I don't know. Life is eternal anyhow. I'm going to shut this. It's not too hot, right?
No.
Yeah. And so, yeah, 20 months later, during that 20 months, I'm swearing it off in the mornings. And in the afternoon, I'm getting started again. And my workshop is a half a block from the liquor store. And I did leather work at that time. And I'd cut rectangles of leather and sew zippers on. And that's what I did for a living, like what people do in psych wards. That's what I did for a profession. And I made myself a backpack that holds a 12-pack of beer. And my status in life was that I could go to this Radio Square Liquor just a half a block away and walk in, and there'd be three or four people in line, and I could just go grab a 12-pack and a bottle of vodka for the alcoholic mechanics next door and a bottle of cranberry juice, lay it down on top of the 12-pack in my backpack, and put exact change on the counter and wave at Casey, the manager, and I didn't have to stand in line because I'm Billy. Although back then, I was Bill back then. But anyhow, I could just walk in, trap down exact change, and that was my status, you know, I got it going on. And it's kind of funny because in my drinking days, I went to the same liquor store in sobriety. At one point, I quit smoking and got the, you know, cookie ice cream thing going on. And when I started doing that, I went to different stores. I didn't want people knowing as a pig. I don't care if they thought I was an alcoholic, but I didn't want people knowing as a pig. It's kind of funny how it is. But anyhow, so in that environment, where I live is three blocks over. Here's where I live, and three blocks is my workshop where the sewing machine is. And here's Carol's restaurant. And I get a pack of Camel Straights and two cups of coffee to go and a newspaper and come back over to my workshop. And the kiddos is right by the liquor store. So I come back to my workshop and sit at the sewing machine, and I'm not drinking today, and drink my two cups of coffee and smoke a few Camel Straights, read the newspaper, and then maybe get some work done or maybe not. And then sooner or later, someone come by with a six pack, say, "Hey, can you fix this for me?" And I'd say, "Sure." And like, "Oh no, not again." And pop it open, and "Oh yes, one more time." If someone didn't stop by and ask for that, then the alcoholic mechanics next door, 3 or 4 in the afternoon, they'd say, "Hey, Billy, we'll buy if you fly." And so I go get them the bottle of vodka and the cranberry juice, and I get my 12-pack of, for a while it was Budweiser, and toward the end days it was Old Milwaukee. And every now and then, if I was doing really good, it'd be a 6-pack of Heineken or something to get started with. And so I would get to that point in the day, and if someone didn't stop by for someone 6 and the alcoholic mechanics didn't ask me to go run, then sooner or later on my own, I just, like, I got something done. Maybe I actually worked for an hour or something. And it's like, okay, one more time. But I always remember that feeling, you know, "No, not again." And, "Oh, yes, one more time." And so anyhow, that was what it was like. And one day, okay. Now at this point, I'm going to stop the day before my first day of sobriety. And I'm going to go back in time. On the day I was born, I had 4 sisters. By the time I was 6 years old, I had 8 sisters. And my brother came along when I was 8 years old. And when I got a brother, it was such a relief. Instead of being 8-1, it was 4-1. And it was a mix. we're all still alive. I moved up here 14 years ago to be across the street from my aging parents. And my mom, as it happened, passed away in 07, and my dad in 010. And my mom passed away on my brother's 50th birthday. He's the baby of the family. So she lived till we were all 50. And she was really glad I was up here across the street. She knew I was safe. There was one time I had to pick her up out of the bathtub because she couldn't get out. And it was weird being a son to my buck-naked mom that couldn't stand up, and the people that were helping her couldn't get her up. But being able to be there for her, there was all kinds of really difficult challenges related to my dad. I'm not going to go too far into them, but if I didn't have a bunch of sisters and brother and stuff, you know, a lot of family members that are involved, I might be more specific or whatever. But suffice it to say that there was times that were really, really difficult. Along the way, growing up, and so on. Growing up, one thing that was really interesting was that I was either the center of attention or I was totally isolated. And I learned I can be isolated, and now I can be isolated and productive. I used to be isolated just to be isolated, or not to be connecting to anybody. And some people can't stand to be alone, and they're always in a relationship or whatever, even if they're in the wrong relationship, just because they can't be alone. And I'm really in sobriety. People used to say to me, a transplant from Santa Barbara, they say, Billy, how's your love life? And I'd say, I'm getting more eligible. And then they ask so many times, they quit asking. And here I am all these years later, still getting more eligible. And now I'm getting too old. Not too old, but I'm definitely getting older. But but I'm good. That's like, what I really want to get to is sharing what recovery is like, because that's what I really got going on in spades. You know, we all know what it's like to get wasted. But back to the family for a few minutes. There's a big Catholic family. Each child, when they got to a certain age, it was time for First Communion, it was time for confirmation, it was time for this, time for that. I was in the boys' choir at the church, you know, whatever, that stuff, and wearing a red robe and singing and being an altar boy, all that kind of stuff. And there was a time when I had an unbreakable, unshakable love of God, just flat out. And nothing will ever come between me and my love of God. And by the end of my drinking days, I had disdain for God, if there was a God. And so through alcohol, my whole spiritual life totally disintegrated. I was the top SAT student in my high school, the senior year. I mean, top SAT score. I was student body president. I had it going on. It's like being in the middle of a big family, you're kind of watching out this way and that way, and someone younger saying, hey, can you help me? Or someone older saying, and if you're the guy, hey, can you help me? Or I went to the grocery store with my mom, and I was shopping with coupons, and I've carried a 50-pound sack of potatoes and all this kind of stuff, and being logistical and being handy, being able to focus on a lot of different things, being able to be in three different conversations at the same time, and also being able to be totally articulate in a conversation just by saying, uh-huh, because the women are just going on. And so being in on that conversation, just say a word every 3 or 4 minutes, and it's a big laugh, you know. And it's like, anyhow, there's lots of things about it that was really good and precious, and there's things about it that were really hard and difficult, and that's life. And so when I was a senior in high school, I went to Bishop High School in Santa Barbara. It was a Catholic high school, and it had to be accredited. Every 5 years, the high school's got to be accredited. And there was like a 17 or 22 page questionnaire, and all the students and all the faculty had to fill it out, and the results had to be collated, and a report had to be done up. And that was handed off to me. They didn't have staff to do it, and they gave it to me to do, and that's what I did in my high school senior year. And I had, you know, some fun on weekends and stuff like that. And having older sisters when people got married, when sis got married, there'd be a wedding and they'd drink some, or there was times my folks, they had parties and they drank, my dad drank heavy. I don't think he wasn't an alcoholic, but he would drink heavy. He liked getting lit, but he would stop. He never went, you know, he never disappeared for 3 days or anything like that. And my mom, she liked to have a couple of drinks, and every now and then she'd be passed out on the couch from too much wine or something in the afternoon. But she had like 10 of us in 17 years. So, I mean, she had motherhood going on, you know, high, full tilt for a long time. And so sometimes she was just worn out. Along the way, when there was parties, we had relatives, we had this one set of relatives, Uncle Jack and Aunt Vi, they passed away in the last few years. I think they were alcoholic, but they managed, you know, they're definitely heavy drinkers. But anyhow, sometimes when there was alcohol going around, I would have a drink or I'd have a sip or whatever, and I liked that. But it was in high school a few times. Basically what I'm getting at is that when I drank in high school, like at one of my sister's weddings or at a high school thing, I drank what was there, but I usually didn't go jonesing for more. As long as there was more there to drink, I kept on going, but once it was gone, I wasn't jonesing for it. And after high school, in high school, in like freshman year, it was like my older sister, immediate older sister's girlfriends, immediate younger sister's girlfriends wanted to go out with me. So they say so-and-so wants to go out with me, so I'd go out with so-and-so, go out with so-and-so, and I hardly ever thought about who did I want to go out with, who did I want to go out with, and that part of me is a little bit retarded, but it's coming to life, I'm figuring it out. Better late than never. But from the second half of my junior year and through my senior year, I had my high school sweetheart that I wanted to marry and make babies with and figure out life as you go along. And that's what I thought it was about. I thought college was for people who needed to be told what to think about. You know, if you can't figure it out as you go along, go to college and they'll help you. And that's what I thought. And I had with the SAT score I had a scholarship to any college in California that I'd want to go to. And my dad didn't fill out the paperwork. It went on his desk. Probably got lost in a pile, and I don't know what happened, but I didn't care because it made room for someone else that could use that scholarship, you know, that wanted to go to college or whatever. You know, some people say, you know, you should go to medical school, you should become a doctor or whatever, and it's like, well, there's only so many spaces in medical school, so let someone else have that. And there was all kinds of stuff in the air about Vietnam. I graduated high school in 67. I remember avoiding higher education because they knew how bright I was. They might make me into some kind of person I don't want to be. And stuff like, you know, just my thinking was kind of strange. Surprise, surprise. Halfway through summer after high school, my high school sweetheart tells me that she's moving 3,000 miles to Florida to go to school. And her dad had been going to UCSB and got his PhD, got a job at Florida State, and they're going to Tallahassee. And she wants to be a teacher, and she's going to a four-year school, and I had no idea. I just thought we were going to figure out, get married sometime before long, start making babies, and do it as we go along. But anyhow, so it wasn't like that. And I went out and saw her at Christmas time after, and it was like, it was really good to see her, it was good to be together. And then a month or so later, I got a letter from her, and she wanted to join a sorority. And it was like, I was totally freaked, totally like, she's going to be some fraternity guy, and she's going to be all gone. And so I got angry, I got insecure, I got jealous, I got fearful. And on her birthday, which is March 11th, which is not that long after Christmas, I cussed her out. I was drunk and just cussed her out and didn't talk to her until we were 25. Turned out she didn't marry until she was 29. And anyhow, that's another thing. But anyhow, so along the way, I just went downhill, very slowly. I have a woman friend who's lesbian, who her and her girlfriend were having a fight, and the girlfriend pulled out a gun, and my friend struggled with it, and the gun went off and blew off a piece of my friend's head, and she has this crease in her head. She lives in Mississippi. And she was in a coma immediately. She was in ICU for a month. She was in rehab for a year. And she's partially paralyzed on her left side, hands a little shriveled, and but she walked with a limp, she can drive a car, she's totally emotionally alive and verbally articulate. A year or two ago, she just got her master's degree and stuff like that. Her name's Niece. Hi, Niece, in case you ever listen to this. Anyhow, we relate, and she's not an alcoholic, but she was a girlfriend of a woman who was renting a room from me at that time, who, God bless Debbie S., shot herself after a sundowner meeting in Santa Barbara. But anyhow, so Niece had this experience of gunshot wound to the head, and we related because what happened to her as quick as a gunshot happened to me over 16 years, say from the age of 19 to the age of 35, when I finally got my permanent sobriety here. The 16 years of such slow downhill, I didn't even know I was going downhill. But if I wound up where I wound up from where I started 16 years earlier, like I'm at City College, I'm 19, and now I'm 35, and I'm in this workshop that's like from that window to that wall and to this wall, just, you know, getting wasted, whatever. If that happened that fast, I would be in shock. I would be totally traumatized. What happened? Where am I? Who am I? What's going on? And so we related because what happened to her quick as a gunshot happened to me over 16 years. We're all partially paralyzed on the inside. We all have emotional disabilities. Some of us may have physical disabilities from our being out there. We might have a foot that's twisted backwards and it won't twist forward anymore because of some car accident or whatever. But on the inside, we're all messed up. We all come in here very messed up. And because we stop doing what's messing us up and we do the steps, we begin to come to life and we begin to become rehabilitated and we begin to live life on life terms and we begin to be able to have some sense of celebration of life, at least every now and then. And so I like to say that to a newcomer, especially to treat yourself like you're in ICU. You know, you're not in a coma, you're in ICU, and you're in rehab. It's not really just for a year, we're in rehab for the rest of our lives. You know, I'm rehabilitating now. I'm a better man today than I was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and that's because I'm willing to grow along spiritual lines, which is one of my favorite lines in the big book. So let's see here. So cussed out my high school sweetheart, that was the end of that. Vietnam War was going on. I had a student deferment for a while. Eventually I got my 1A classification, had my physical. I'd had a splenectomy when I was a child, so there was some delay on whether or not they would accept me because of that. I got a telegram from the Marine Corps on a Friday night at 5 o'clock. I remember it clear as a bell, and it said, join the Marines now because otherwise you're going to be going into the Army, you're going to get drafted on Monday. So on Monday I went down to the post office and applied for conscientious objector because I wasn't, you know, I just, what I saw about the war at that time, this is in 68, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that it wasn't American or patriotic or whatever, it was a patriotic thing for me to do to become a conscientious objector. And that was a process that took a year or two to go through. And while I'm drinking and getting loaded, I'm not living life. Like I grew up, you know, I remember maybe 9 or 10, 11 years old, sunshine and sparkly, and life is beautiful. God is amazing. Love is everything. And, you know, it was God, Catholicism, my family, and my country, and that was my hierarchy of priorities. And I had priorities, and they were totally strong, unbreakable, unshakable. And they all went away. And anyhow, so let's see. So in going through that process, getting a conscientious objector, they came up with a draft lottery, and they drafted to 195 the year I was in the lottery, and I was 199. If I'd have gotten drafted, I would have done alternative service, but I wasn't, and I didn't. And but that whole period of my life, like growing up, it was like, it was weird, because I didn't know, the way I was raised is like going to be a priest, and the way I like girls, I was like, I'm going to get married and have 10 children like my dad. And as it happened, and if I was going to be a priest, I was going to be the Pope, at least an archbishop, you know, whatever. And getting married, yeah, 10 children. And as it happened, none of that stuff ever happened. And so the love of life, the zest for life, the celebration of life, all that stuff was gone because of my alcoholism. Not just my alcoholism, it's because Robert Kennedy got shot, it's because John Kennedy got shot, it's because Martin Luther King got shot, and Malcolm X got shot. And this whole world that I grew up in, especially when John Kennedy got shot, it just changed and changed. And I remember I just kind of went on a strike. I was 2 or 3 years sober, and I was watching a History Channel. It was like a one-hour special on Robert Kennedy. And it came to the night that he was shot. He won the California primary. It was June 5th, I think, in 68. It was like a month and a half after Martin Luther King was killed. I just checked out. It's like, I'm done. I'm out of here. I'm not showing up for life. I'm not interested in being a part of this. And it's cool. It's part of what sobriety brings you. Last week I was in Atlanta for 6 days for a 3-day conference on the Palestinians, which is, you know, my interest in life or outside issues, but that is one of my interests in life. But also I have a great niece, back up, I have a niece who died of cancer about 18 years ago, and her daughter is 29 now, and she has a 6-year-old son and she has a 10-week-old daughter, and she lives with the father of her second child in Atlanta. And I got a round trip ticket. I was debating on going to this conference, and I always pray for knowledge, God's will, and the power to carry it out. And I got on a cheapair.com. It's like, it was $700 and whatever.com. And then I found this one, cheapoair.com, and I'm not meaning to give Alcoholics Anonymous approves of this or endorses cheapoair.com, but part of my experience, strength and hope. I got a round trip ticket out of Santa Maria for $394. I parked my car, flew to Frisco, flew to Atlanta, flew back, and flew back. But anyhow, so I got to hold this 10-week-old daughter and her great-great-niece in my arms, and I got to talk to my great-niece, and we never had many long conversations, and one of the deals on getting the cheap ticket was I had to go a day earlier than I planned, which gave more time to be with family, and I stayed a day later, and so on. And my niece shared with me how, because her mom, my niece Debbie, was diagnosed with cancer, and this is another one for newcomers and for y'all, but she was diagnosed with cancer when my great niece Alicia was 6 years old. Her mom Debbie was diagnosed with cancer, ovarian cancer, and it kills most women that get it in 6 months. And she had surgery and chemo and radiation, and she got into remission. I remember we had a barbecue at her house, and she could eat real food and stuff like that, no more eating out of a tube. And then it came back, and she had surgery and chemo and radiation again, and she had remission, and then it came back, and she was too weak to have surgery again, and she had chemo and radiation, and then she passed on. But she stayed for five years from when she was first diagnosed. And the point of that is that we have a deadly disease, and we're able to be in remission by doing this, by showing up in our recovery for an hour or two a day, you know, being there for other people, being there for ourselves, embracing life in recovery, embracing the spiritual life. If Alcoholics Anonymous cost $200 a day, and if you had really good health insurance, it was covered, but if it, you didn't have good insurance, it wasn't covered, you'd be pissed if you couldn't get insurance to go to AA. You know, I want to go. And the doctor said, well, okay, well, you can go once a month, but insurance won't pay for more than that. I want to go every day. They say you should be here every day. I'm sorry, we can't. $200 a day, we can't pay that. You know, you'd be pissed why you can't be here every day. But it's not $200 a day. It's priceless. You just have what the price is. Now, this club that we belong to, this organization we belong to, it's like the most exclusive organization in the world. We pay the highest dues for membership. The price we paid to be here, each of us, if it just us in this room, you know, we add all that up, it's like, holy smokes, you buy this building, like three of them in a row, and the library, for the price we paid to be here. So, anyhow, where am I? So, yeah, so the message is be in remission. I'm not, you know, why am I here? I got a year's sobriety yesterday for the 31st time in a row. One day at a time. I remember when I was 20-some days sober, and that heavy idea, I can never ever drink again. If I want to be sober, I can't ever drink again. It was so heavy. And then I realized what they're talking about, one day at a time. And the next thing I realized, which was like my higher power tapping on my shoulder, says, you can't say you can't do it, because I already did it 20-some times. And each of us in this room, as far as I know, has at least a day or two. And if we all do, you can't say you can't do it. So, but thank God it's not just on us, like, oh, I got it 27 days so I can do it. See you guys later. No. I can do it because being here, I hear people say when they walked in the room for Alcoholics Anonymous, they were home. And I want to give a shout out to Suzanne Myers, who passed away on Thursday, if you didn't know. But she was one of those people that she was home when she got here. And tall John, shout out to John from the airport in the Lion's Den. There's a memorial on Tuesday, 6 o'clock at Lion's Den Potluck and Memorial. And John, he was home here many times. He kept coming back, but the last time he got here, he got over 10 years of sobriety. And John, he had lung cancer, and he was emaciated, and he was at a meeting a day or two before he passed away, right up to the end. He could have easily been in bed on morphine or whatever and just fade away. And he wanted to die sober. He wanted to die embracing Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's exactly what he did. And God bless you, John, and so on. I could go on about people that have passed on recently or a while ago. So I'm going to go to about 7 after, and it's time. Let's see now. Yes, sober. I went through the war, and what happened to my friend, quick as a gunshot, happened to me over many years. Okay, so after the war, I'm like 22 or something, and I wanted to marry this one woman from Canada. It's a long story, and I'm telling it really fast, short. I wound up almost marrying her sister, but then I was going across the border, and I got declined going into Canada, so they kicked me out of there. They wouldn't let me back in the States, and she had dinner going on at 6 p.m. in Edmonton. Sorry, Chris, and sorry, Wanda. And I had to call her and say, I'm not going to be there. I can't get into the country. And it was at the time that they were looking for draft dodgers and stuff, but it's a long story, the whole thing. But nevertheless, went through that. Later on, this other woman that I thought, like, we loved each other a lot, she was very much on pills and alcoholic, and she caught flu, and she died 3 days later. And then Laura. But anyhow, so there was one time in my drinking days when I started. Okay, so one time when I was 26, I was living in my car, and I wound up in a recovery house. And I wound up with a drunk driving. From the drunk driving, I got into a recovery house. I was in the recovery house to not be living in my car. I had to dot my I's, cross my T's there. I had to go to the meetings I was supposed to go to. And while I was there, I got a job. There was a manager of a department at a big company in Goleta. So I got a job, and the 4th of July came up, and the 4th of July picnic came up, and the whole house went to the AA picnic, and I went to the company picnic. And at the company picnic, they had a couple of kegs of beer, and it had been 6 or 8 weeks since I drank, and I knew a couple of beers wasn't going to hurt me none. And had a couple of beers from when I got sober 26, and 9 years went by. So it's like, don't take it for granted if you go out that you're going to be back anytime soon. So when I got here at 35, I'm going to kind of pack it in here. Not pack it in. This is me the year before I got sober. Okay? A lot of you have this. If you don't have it, you have one now. Picture's worth 1,000 words. I want you to know that I know what it's like to be wasted. And I know what it's like to be sober. Sober's better. I don't have to go out and have tapes anymore. And what it is for them, you know, I got really shot out from my drinking and using days. It's a combination of what I like too much. And there's a song by the Beatles, you know, move my mind out in the car, that notes of the lights it seems. And that was kind of like me. And there's been a long rehabilitation coming together. So my mom stops by my workshop, her and one of my sisters. This is about, you know, we've done all the family stuff and everything. So my mom and one of my sisters invited me to have coffee on a Friday night. And I went and had coffee with them at Carol's. And the following Monday, my mom stops by and she says, your dad and I stopped by, saw a therapist. And we were wondering if you would see this therapist. And I had been thinking about seeing a therapist since my friend Laura Brown. I never connected with her parents. If there was a memorial, I didn't know about it. I took care of my emotional life with alcohol. And so I had been thinking about seeing a therapist. My mom, in other words, some people get here because they're on the court card, or they're out there. You know, Keith saw the light. He hit the hit a light pole. Some people wind up here in the psych ward. Some people wind up here just totally demoralized or whatever. And I was, like, apathetic. I was beyond demoralized. I was just showing up in life, cutting rectangles with leather, selling at the arts and craft show every now and then. And anyhow, so I saw this therapist and talked about my friend Laura and got to experience some of my grief. And she asked me not to drink till I saw her the next week. And out of the clear blue, I said yes, and I was able to. And when I called to make the appointment with her on the Monday, I had a couple of beers left in the fridge and some cigarettes left in my pack, but I recognized I'd never given myself a chance at life, period. I was always avoiding it or responding with alcohol and drugs. So I'd never given myself a chance. And so I decided early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. I had my last couple of beers, and my last cigarettes. I went to bed. It was 10 o'clock at night on October 1st, and couldn't get sleep. And I got up and I went to the Safeway, and I got a pint of rum and a liter of Coca-Cola and a pack of Camel Straights. And went home and turned on the TV, and there was some movie on from 11 to 1, and my living room was like, there's a wood crate here for my ashtray and my beer, and there was a wood crate there with my black and white TV. I was watching some movie from 11 to 1, but then from 1 to 3 there was a movie on called The Heart is the Lonely Hunter. And that was the metaphor for me, you know, the heart is the lonely hunter. And I remember seeing it, and then I guess the movie's over, there's this much left in my glass, the bottle's empty. I tip it up, I look at the clock, and it's 3:02 in the morning, October 2nd, 1984. And as it happened, that was it. It reminds me, like the end of my drinking, was like that feather in Forrest Gump, that feather that floats down to the park bench. That was me at the end of my drinking. And I was just willing to try life different. I was willing to not be living how I'd lived. I was knowing that how I had been living was not living. I didn't care if I had a life. but I wanted to be sober. I didn't want to drink anymore. And anyhow, so I called a therapist, saw this 1 week, said, don't drink till you see me next week. And I said, sure. So I got sober on the 1 week at a time program, which it worked for me. It was God's grace at that time. I remember early on recognizing, holy smokes, that while the day before I got sober, I had disdain for God if there was a God, the fact that I was willing to be sober was a blessing of some kind of gift and some kind of grace. And I brought a prop. I meant to get a lot farther on my talk by now, but I didn't. But I have a prop with some newcomers, especially, although each of you might enjoy it. And it's like, I'll share my desire to be sober is my most precious gift in life. I don't care what things seem like. I don't care what it looks like. It looks like everything's coming my way. It looks like everything's going the other way. It looks like I never measured up. It looks like I'm totally spot on. It doesn't matter what it looks like, what it seems like, what it feels like, compared to the fact that I have a desire to stop drinking. That's my most precious gift. All the other stuff is relative. This has to be permanent. Okay? It's like a candle. And this is like Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. And that's me. I'm going to keep that flame burning. Keep it where it's safe. Where it ain't going to burn out. And it's going to stay lit. So I do that by attending meetings, saying hi to newcomers. It's fine that I have. It's from, I can tell it, well, actually I did. I want to tell a lot more about sobriety than I have time to tell. I recognized it as some kind of blessing. That was the beginning of my spiritual life. Some kind of blessing, some kind of gift, some kind of grace. That today I'm willing to be sober, yesterday I wasn't. There's a definite difference. One day that candle is there and I don't have it going on, and the next day it's lit. Okay? And I could blow that candle out. I could go get a bottle of Jack Daniels or whatever. I could lie to myself, totally lie to myself and say, it's 31 years, my liver's better, my emotional life's better, my financials, you know, it's all better. You know, I deserve. I've been 31 times around the sun without a drink. Nobody does that, except Trish. anyhow, so that's beginning my spiritual life. Then on the steps, boy, I wish I could go. Anyhow, so I'm going to skip the first step because I don't want to go through all the steps, but I want to emphasize on the second step, came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I mistook in the three pertinent ideas, it says A, B, and then it says C, that God could and would if sought. And I transposed in my own mind, and I shared it, and Joanne adopted it, is that came to believe a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. And I came to believe, before I came to believe God would restore me to sanity, I came to believe there's people in the room that believe that. So at some point, we're going to have to begin to believe something. And nobody's going to tell you how to believe or what to believe in or whatever, but to believe a power greater than yourself can restore to sanity. Then about turning your will and your life over to the care of God, I'd like to just share this, that there was a point in my drinking where I was thinking, a point in my sobriety where I was thinking about drinking, and I was considering drinking Jack Daniels, getting a bottle, and I recognized that if I drink Jack Daniels, if I drink alcohol, I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of alcohol. And at that point in time, I realized I'd done that countless times. And it's always an ego trip for some, well, not always, some people here that they're not, I'm not going to turn my will and my life over to the care of nothing. And the truth is, if you're honest with yourself, you turn your will and your life over to the care of alcohol or pot or this guy or that, whatever, and so on, many times. Every time I drank, I turned my will and my life over. So anyhow, I want to share that. So you can do the third step sooner or later. So I want to share real fast about commitments. Along the way, when I first got sober, can I go to 10 after?
Sure.
2 minutes after? Okay.
Sure.
So along the way, I did not have the... I saw the therapist next week. She gave me a book to read, talked about alcoholism, gave me a book to read called Under the Influence. and said, would you read this? And then the next week, I came back, and she said, would you go to an AA meeting? So I had 2 weeks sobriety when I got to an AA meeting. Under the Influence talks about progressivity of alcoholism, that having a large, 4 stages, large capacity to drink, using alcohol as an emotional response to life, having to have alcohol to function, and wet brain cirrhosis and death. And that's somewhere between the second and third stage. I totally used alcohol for my emotional response to life. I didn't know, I didn't think I had to have it to function, but I was years sober when I realized I didn't have to function. You know, until Saturday night at 6 p.m. I had to get some leather work done for the art show, but I didn't have dependence and so on. So maybe if I'd had to function, I would have had to have a drink to function. But anyhow, I'm on that continuum. Wet brain cirrhosis and death await me if I decide to drink. Anyhow, so I didn't have empathy for alcoholics when I got here. I had a desire to stop drinking, and thank God the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. If you think you're an addict and you don't, and not think you're an addict, but if you are an addict or you identify as an addict, but you like what you have going on here and you know that alcohol takes you to your addiction, we don't ask you to identify as an alcoholic, but we do ask you to identify as, I have a desire to stop drinking. If you have a desire to stop drinking and you want to be a member, you are a member. If you don't have a desire to stop drinking and you want to be a member, sorry, you're not a member. You got to have a desire to stop drinking. But nobody's going to, that's for you to judge yourself. Anyhow, so I didn't have empathy that way, but I did from having a bunch of sisters. And I was on State Street, and there was a card table. There was women from Shelter Services handing out documents, you know, just flyers and literature and whatever, and asking people for money and so on. And I didn't have money, and I grabbed a flyer, and I put it on the stack next to my desk, next to my sewing machine. And over the next couple of weeks, I ran into a one-ton long van with a roof rack. It was like $450, and I didn't have money, but I had leather, and I called this friend that had leather, and she bought $450 worth of leather from me, and I got that long van. And I could see God's fingerprints on the situation, even though I didn't have a spiritual life going on with God. But I could see this is grace. This is grace. And I got that long van, and then a week or two later, I'm going through the bills next to my sewing machine. There's this thing from Shelter Services, and it says, can you donate money or time or other? And I checked other, and I says, I have a van you can use. Like a new one, women got to get out of some place. They might like to borrow a van so they can get out of there and get over to the shelter or whatever. And so I offered to loan my van. Well, the next day I got a phone call from Carol Eck, who was the director in Santa Barbara at that time. She says, Mr. Norris, we're glad to hear from you. And for the next couple of few years, I was picking up donations, taking them to the Long Pole Thrift Store. I set up the Santa Maria shelter. I took payroll to Santa Maria, to Long Pole, to change beds at Santa Barbara. All this stuff they needed a guy to do. And I remember with this long van, at one time I had a couch in the van and boxes all around it, and I had 2 couches on the roof rack, like one that way and one flipped over on top of it, and I did it all myself. And I wish I had, it was a Kodak moment, but I don't have a picture of it. But now, from being around there, then they needed to move to the Women's Community Center, which was a bigger building, and I did the same thing over there. And then the Red Crisis Center was over there, and the women from there saw this guy around moving couches and stuff like that, and he said, hey, can you give us a hand with this? Well, the next thing, I'm working on fundraisers with the Red Crisis, and the next thing, I'm a site coordinator for Take Back the Night March when I'm 4 years sober. I got to speak ahead of Gloria Allred. I got to speak because I was a man and I had 8 sisters. I had to write it out. It's single space on 8.5 by 11, and I think I have it somewhere. I haven't seen it since then. But in logistics, and this is for the men in the room, there's times we've got to be logistical. We're not emotional, period. We're just focus on the details, got to handle this, got to handle that, and took care of light, sound, chairs, restroom, wheelchair access, all this kind of stuff, not doing it personally, but make sure it all got done, and then step up these steps to the podium to talk to 700 or 800 people at Delaguerra Plaza and get into my emotional life and express what I had to express, and then step back down so the women can focus on the program, and they did their march, and we cleaned up, and it was all taken, they didn't have to think twice about all that stuff. Yeah, that's an example of that. And I volunteered at central office in Santa Barbara, and answering the phone, there was this guy that was bald that would come running in and out, and he was tearing his hair out even though he was bald. He was a treasurer, had been the treasurer for 3 years, and he was just burned out and done with it. And they needed one, and God said, Billy, it's got your name on it. And so I said, I can do that. So he had it on a computer, and for me up to until that time, computers were for people who could not figure things out in their head, because I could figure it out as I go along. Rectangles of leather, zippers, what's to figure out. Anyhow, so here on computer, from that I learned how to do a computer, which from that, when I was 2 years sober, a drinking buddy of mine gave me the photo that's on that card, which 10 years later I knew how to do graphics, and instead of having a card that said one day at a time, Billy, and my phone number, God said, do this, picture's worth a thousand words. And so I did. And I volunteered to do that for anybody that's not an ego trip whatsoever. It's just God's grace to be able to catch the newcomers dashing out of the room and say, hey, I know what it's like. Anyhow, so fortunately I recorded this and I have the ability, and you guys are all being quiet, so I have the ability to edit this. So maybe I'll tell the rest of the story later on before I put it on the website. But it is 10 after, and I don't want to keep you too long. But I could, you know, it goes on and on, and you know, we're willing to grow along spiritual lines, and there is no end in sight on that. So I love you all for being here, for sharing this gift of life and sobriety. Welcome to Land of Living, the home of the free and the brave. And just no matter what's going on, keep that candle burning. Thank you.
Right, how much would I have for Billy and Steve?